Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would happen if you woke up tomorrow with a serious illness? If you have really good insurance through your employer, you might be able to weather the financial crisis, even if you rack up hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills before you're on your feet again. But if you leave or lose your job down the line and find yourself looking to buy on the open market, there's a very good chance that nobody will even sell you a health insurance policy. A PBS Frontline documentary airing tonight at 9 on KERA 13 television looks at the perfect storm of skyrocketing healthcare costs, tightening underwriting standards, and an economy forcing millions of people out of jobs that once guaranteed they could get coverage. John Palfreyman is a producer at Frontline and joins us now to talk about tonight's installment. It's called Sick Around America. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
I have to say, watching the documentary, my first response is outrage. Over and over, we're reminded that in no other developed country are people denied basic and life-saving health services.
No, you're right. I mean, it is outrageous. But for some reason, we're not marching in the streets about this. This has been outrageous for a long time, and it's shocking. I mean, it shocked me looking into this subject that so many things could go on. But for some reason, we haven't done anything, and maybe this is the year in which we do something about it. I don't know.
And beyond the outrage, there are some seemingly intractable issues, including the fact that people who don't see an immediate need for health care often don't enroll for coverage.
Yes, I mean,
incredible selection in the individual market. People wait until they have cancer before they enroll. They wait until they're pregnant before they enroll. So if you only wait until they are very sick before they enroll, cost of premium has to be very high. I mean, literally, if the 1% of the population, or 35% of the cost, are the only people enroll, then the monthly premium to break even is $10,000. So it's very expensive.
So we hear there a clip from the documentary sort of explaining the problem. Are people just choosing not to get coverage if they don't need it?
Well, I think it, if you're young and you don't earn very much income and you feel immortal, you might choose to go without health insurance. And that's a problem because for insurance to work, you have to have a risk pool. You have to have the young and the healthy in with the old and the sick, because all of us, young people will become old people, and all of us healthy people will become sick people. And it's really rather like if you allowed people to choose whether they got car insurance. A lot of people would wait till they had an accident and then go out and try to buy insurance. That doesn't really make much sense. Insurance is voluntary in our system, and that's really what, you know, leads to the problem. So it's pretty obvious that you can't just require insurance companies to cover everybody unless you require people to join in. Otherwise, you do get very expensive premiums.
How many Americans right now are insured through an employer?
About 160 million. It's basically the most common way we get insurance. But in any three-year period, one in four Americans are transitioning between jobs or between marriages or between states, and they slip in and out of into the individual market. So it's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, and in fact, it comes up in the film, I think, that there are people who are not divorcing because they can't afford to lose their health coverage.
Yes, you see, there's lots of strange things about our system. One is that people would stay in jobs and stay in marriages, plan their lives effectively around health insurance. We have an example of a young college kid who's graduating from college, and he wants to be an industrial chemist, but he's been diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. So when he loses his parents' insurance when he graduates college, which is what happens to all college graduates, he has the problem about he needs a job immediately which carries health insurance, and so he ends up working for Menards, a home improvement center, which is not his first choice, but he, from now on, he has to plan to have health insurance, and he has to find jobs which carry it, because otherwise he's going to be uninsurable in the individual market, and he's going to be very vulnerable.
So we have 160 million people who are insured through work. How many people are required or trying to find insurance on the open market then?
Well, I think at any one time it's about 3%. It's not very large, about 3%, but that 3% keeps changing as we go in and out of jobs and so forth. So anybody there is just one or two life events away. Anyone who's got good insurance through an employer, and particularly now where unemployment is rising very rapidly and you're getting people who sort of, you need to think about this. We have an example. I mean, you saw the example of Paul Stevens in the program. This is a person who had a very good job in a, a communications company in Houston, Texas, and then got laid off. And then his problems began at that moment. And that's the story which I think is being repeated all over America at the moment.
Mm-hmm. This is someone who lost his job, lost his insurance, and then became very ill.
Yes. I mean, first of all, he thought he could get another job with insurance. He couldn't. He tried to get insurance in the individual market. He couldn't. Then he had a heart attack. The heart attack, he was taken to hospital. He was saved. But then he was hit with a bill of $200,000, and he went into bankruptcy, lost his house, and so forth. So,
and now he's living with his mother and just awaiting the day that he'll be able to get on Medicare.
And now he's just waiting for Medicare, which is very tragic.
John Palfreyman is my guest. He's a producer at PBS's Frontline. The special Sick Around America will air tonight at 9 on KERA 13 television. Can you talk for a minute, John, about the sorts of restrictions that insurance companies place on who gets coverage and for what conditions?
Right. Now, if you're applying in the open market, if you apply through your employer, they can't do this. I mean, if you get your health care through an employer, they have to take everybody and treat everybody the same, regardless of age and illness. But if you're applying as an individual, you're subject to what's called medical underwriting, where they will ask you to fill out a questionnaire going back usually 10 years of your health history. And if there's anything you've got that's serious, and even if you've got something that's not particularly serious, they can and probably will exclude you. And the reason they do that is because they don't make money from people who make claims. They really make money. Their business model, it works when they're getting people who aren't ill, who aren't going to make claims. And so they obviously have to take that into account and try to avoid anybody who's sick. So if you've got diabetes or heart disease, you won't get insurance. If you might be pregnant, you won't get insurance. But even if you've got something like hay fever or acne, you may not get insurance.
One of the problems that you discover for some people is a practice among insurance companies called rescission, which is essentially they agree to cover somebody and then they turn around and retroactively retract that coverage. Can you tell us about Patricia Campbell?
Yeah, it's actually Jennifer Thompson is the woman.
Oh, forgive me.
So, I mean, this practice of rescission, I think, is one of the more extraordinary. It's the sort of darkest corner of the insurance industry, because you'd think that the worst thing that could happen to you is being turned down for insurance. But actually, what's worse is getting insurance and then going along, getting ill, and then when you seek to use your insurance, getting rejected. So Jennifer Thompson applies for insurance in the individual market and gets a policy with Blue Cross of California, and then she fills out a questionnaire, a 10-year questionnaire. She signs a paper which gives her insurer all access to her medical records, and they approve her. She starts, she pays her premiums on time and everything, and then she gets cancer very short, you know, a few weeks or a few months into the policy. She goes into hospital for 6 days, and she comes home. It's close to Christmas, and then she gets a letter saying that she's been rescinded, that they've withdrawn her health care. And what they've done is when she made the claim, that triggered an investigation, and they went back and looked at all her records, and they claimed they found some inconsistency that she didn't fill in properly. So she was left uninsured with bills of $160,000, still with cancer, and uninsurable, you know, basically in a situation where nobody would touch her. And that's the situation called rescission that's been revealed in California, where there's, through the reporting of Lisa Girion of the LA Times, lots of cases have come to light.
Yeah, let's listen now to Lisa talking about what she learned when reporting for the LA Times.
Fraud means that an individual knew something, was aware of something, and didn't put it down. They were trying to put one over on the insurance company. But that is not what typically is happening in these rescission cases that I uncovered. It would be something where individuals would fill out an application, and the question would be, do you have a mental illness? And they would say, no, I'm not mentally ill. And the thing that they get rescinded for is being on Prozac for 6 months after their father's death 10 years ago. A brief period of grieving didn't seem to be, you know, the answer to the question, are you mentally ill?
I wonder, John, even about people who happen to forget something that happened a number of years ago and how often that is grounds for rescission.
All right. I mean, I think it's very difficult because they don't specify in advance what can get you rejected. And so obviously the suspicion is this is a way of, you know, at the time they're signing you up, they want to get you in very quickly because it's a competitive market for the insurance companies, and that this is a kind of an escape hatch with which you can jettison people if they turn out to be costly. And in some of the court cases that have surfaced in California, it's been clear that there have been staff that have been paid bonuses for the number of rescissions they've actually done, because they end up saving their companies a lot of money. So it's very difficult to make this practice seem humane in any way. It's a very difficult thing to justify.
And you went to the industry and said, what is the deal here? And they said, look, we're only trying to keep the business afloat.
Yeah, I mean, they want to keep it affordable. They claim that if it's so competitive that if one of them stops rescission, they'll go out of business. But, you know, there's a realization in the industry which surprised me that basically the current system, they don't really try to defend very hard the current system. You know, they would prefer a system where everybody's covered, but they can't do it unless everybody's required to buy insurance. So I think that's the basic formula. You've got to have everybody in order to get them to move to cover everybody if they're going to have a role in a reformed system.
Is there legislation pending to change how the insurance companies can exclude people?
Well, certain states have tried it, and the most interesting state at the moment is Massachusetts, where in 2006 they brought in this double mandate. They required insurance companies to cover everybody, and they required everybody to buy insurance, and you get fined in Massachusetts if you don't get insurance. And if you're poor, you get subsidized. And it's been pretty successful in a way. They've got over 97% of people insured, which is the highest rate of any state. But they've run into this other problem, which is really seems to me now to be the biggest problem we've got to face, which is the costs, the medical costs are going up so fast that it's very difficult to kind of insist. You can only mandate people to buy insurance if they can afford it. And even a person who earns more than 300% of the federal poverty level, a family of earning more than $60,000, has trouble affording insurance, because the average policy for a family of four now for health care insurance for a year is about $13,000. So that's very difficult to afford, even if you earn $60,000. I mean, it's like 15% of your income. More.
The Massachusetts experiment has revealed a basic truth: that changing health care is not just about covering everyone. It's also about controlling medical costs. Massachusetts has among the highest medical costs in the country, and insurance premiums there have been rising at about 10% a year.
I don't know, hard to say.
According to Dr. Tom DelBanco, professor of medicine and primary care at Harvard Medical School, a leader in patient-centered care, all the major stakeholders in the healthcare system are responsible for the runaway costs.
Some of the doctors, I think, make too much money. Some of the institutions make too much money. Some of the pharmaceutical companies bring in too many dollars. Some of the insurance industry, for sure, makes too much money. I think a lot of doctors are angry about them. And in the end, it adds up to an awful lot of money.
What percentage, John, of every healthcare dollar spent in America today actually pays for medical treatment?
Well, it's around 85%, 85 cents on the dollar. I mean, basically, most insurance has administrative costs of around 10%, and then if the company's a for-profit company, it's on average about 5 or 6%. And it might go a little higher with some companies, but maybe 15 to 18% is tied up. And then the hospitals, the medical providers, they also have administrative costs because the system's so complex. So by the time you factored in administrative costs of the providers, maybe you're left with about 75 cents of every dollar which goes to medical care. So medical care is still the biggest factor in what's driving healthcare costs. Even if you remove the profit, and even if you made the administrative costs, you know, get smaller, you'd still be left with the big ones, which would be, you know, there's all the scans, all the treatments, all the specialty visits, all the drugs, all those kinds of things.
John Palfreyman is my guest. He's a PBS Frontline producer whose documentary Sick Around America will air tonight at 9 on KERA 13 television. You're welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is PBS Frontline producer John Palfreyman, whose new special, Sick Around America, will air tonight at 9 on KERA 13 television as part of the Frontline series. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, you have a very poignant story in the film about a young woman who was diagnosed with lupus, working very hard to take good care of herself, and ultimately couldn't get coverage. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, this is a story of a woman called Nikki White, and when she's 21, she's diagnosed with a condition called lupus, which is an autoimmune disease whereby your body attacks your own sort of connective tissue. It's a pretty horrible disease, used to be fatal, but can be managed pretty well, and so most people with lupus live a pretty normal lifespan now. You need treatment from a specialist rheumatologist, and you need expensive drugs. And she was basically unable to sort of to work this out. She took jobs with insurance for a while, then she became too sick, and she went home to Tennessee, where she picked up insurance under the state Medicaid program, which is the program for the poor and the disabled. But those programs are quite fickle, so when state revenues ran down, when they had a bad patch, they changed the eligibility, and she was thrown off the state Medicaid program, and she ended up going to the emergency room where she was treated with multiple operations, and she racked up $900,000 worth of bills, and eventually she died. So she's an example of someone who falls through the safety net, and there's probably, you know, maybe 20,000 such people who die each year in America. It's just one of the things we put up with. To go back to your outrage, where's the outrage.com point at the beginning. Somehow we know it's bad, but we're not sort of mad enough that we've actually caused our elected representatives to change this system yet.
And just to drive home the point, although it would have taken expensive medication and medical treatments to keep this woman healthy, it would not have cost anywhere near $900,000 to do so.
No. I mean, if she just had regular insurance, she needed the drugs and she needed the regular visits to a specialist. And, you know, I think any humane society, I don't think many people would disagree that that ought to be a basic right. That, you know, somebody with lupus shouldn't die just because they've got lupus. They should be able to get the care they need. And we just haven't figured out the system how to do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Bob in Dallas. Hello, Bob.
Hi, how are y'all? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering about a couple of things that I found to be pretty scary, and the workers' compensation system. And the 2-year wait if you become disabled to get the state insurance you were just talking about.
Are you familiar, John, with the 2-year wait?
Bob, are you talking about the high risk pool in Texas?
Not that. Just waiting. If you become disabled, you have to wait 2 years before you can get Medicaid.
Oh wow! I didn't realize that. That would vary from state to state. So it's 2 years in Texas at the moment. That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, apparently that's the case. So have you had to deal with the system yourself, Bob?
Yes, I'm working on it right now. I had a job for 13 years and had an accident and got into the workers' compensation system, and they didn't think it was bad as everybody else did. And so here we are paying quite a bit for health insurance, and, you know, that can't be sustainable. So, you know, we've got to do something. And, you know, it's the deck is really stacked against especially injured workers, not to mention everyone else.
Yeah,
it's a very complicated system. How are you getting your health insurance at the moment, Bob? Are you got COBRA? Are you on the continuation program?
Yes, I'm on COBRA, and that's going to run out pretty soon. And I've got all kind of chronic conditions that you already mentioned.
Right.
And
the thing for you is, if when your COBRA lapses, you've got so many days to get insurance, and when you can get coverage. If you leave it more than, I think, 67 days, you're basically in big trouble, you know, if you were to get ill. So, and Texas is an interesting state. I think it's true, isn't it, Chris, that 25% of people in Texas lack medical insurance. It's one of the highest uninsured states in the country.
It may be, sometimes it is the highest, depending on the year. Yes, it's something that we are very concerned about here. Yeah. How good are the pools of last resort that are available in some states?
I don't think they're very good. I mean, most people don't say they're very good. I mean, this is basically what's called a high-risk pool, and many states have them. And really, they're a place for people who can't get insurance in the private in the market. No one will touch them, and they often have waiting lists. So I think to get into the Texas one, the waiting list is a year or a year and a half. and the premiums are much higher than the private market, so they might be 200% of, you know, the average commercial cost in the private market, because you've got very, very sort of sick people there. So it's a very difficult place to be. I mean, if you're rich and uninsurable, you can sort of get into the high risk pool. But if you don't have money and you're uninsurable, it doesn't really help you. It's pretty small as well. Most people can't afford to go on it. It's almost entirely made up of people over 50, you know, too young for Medicare, too young to retire for this program for seniors, and but sort of old enough that they've got pre-existing conditions, which makes them unattractive to commercial insurers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jerry in Burleson. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest if he sees any hope whatsoever, because I was diagnosed with cancer at 35. I mean, just one day I had leukemia. My world fell apart. And luckily, I had health insurance, but if I hadn't, they said I had to put $150,000 down for a bone marrow transplant. Who on earth can do that?
And but you have insurance now, Jerry?
Yes, I do. Thank the Lord. But is there any hope? I mean, it just seems so hopeless.
And are you getting insurance through your work or through your husband? Or
Jerry, where do you get insurance? Do you get it through your work?
My husband's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I mean, you're lucky, but basically, if your husband gets laid off, I mean, you're still one or two life events away from disaster. You've got to hope that he keeps his job and that your marriage stays and everything works. I mean, you're very vulnerable, and I'm very sympathetic. But you're relatively lucky compared to a lot of people in this country. So when you say hope, are you talking, is there hope for reform or is there just hope for you?
What were you? That they're really going to change anything? Because they've been talking about it for so long and nothing changes.
Right. Well, I think this is one of the years, Jerry, where it's possible. We've got a new president. It's been 10 or 15 years since we tried before. And there seemed to me, making this program, a consensus among medical providers and among insurance company people and among the patients and so forth, that really the current system was unsustainable. It's going up. It's too expensive. It's totally unfair. And it's extremely embarrassing and shameful that people die and people are being rescinded for coverage. I mean, there's no way that you can actually look in the mirror and say this is something that a rich country like America should be doing. And I do think there's a feeling, you know, there's a commitment for change. But the problem is this industry is now our largest industry in this country. It's 17% of our gross domestic product, $2.3 trillion. And you've got some very, very powerful special interests who have to be part of the solution. Otherwise, they will just resist change and stop it like they have in the past.
Another thing we learn in the film, John, is that the concept of medical bankruptcy, which is one of the top reasons that Americans declare bankruptcy these days, is also virtually unheard of in any other developed country.
Yes, and we went around the world. We did a film last year, you may have seen it, called Sick Around the World, where we went to rich countries like Germany, Switzerland, Japan. And the concept of medical bankruptcy is unknown. If you ask the question, how many people in Japan go bankrupt because of medical bills, they literally don't understand the question. Whereas a study out of Harvard by Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard Law School, found that in 700,000 bankruptcies each year, medical bills were a big factor. I mean, it's one of the major reasons why people fall into bankruptcy in this country. And so it's another sort of toxic sort of consequence of our inadequate healthcare system.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Bill in McKinney. Hello, Bill.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, in your film, how does it compare to, like, Michael Moore's film of Sicko, where it shows the statistics were, like, 39th or something in the industrial world in healthcare? Why such a rich nation like us have such a problem with taking care of our people? I don't know if you can answer that question
yeah.
or not.
But. No, I mean, the film we made last year, Sick Around the World, was more like that, in that we went around to different countries. And really, we do compare very unfavorably with other countries. We spend about twice as much as Japan and Britain. We spend a third more than Switzerland and Germany. And we fail to cover 46 million people. And then there's a lot of people who are covered who aren't very well covered, who are still, you know, threatened with bankruptcy. So there's no question that whatever the imperfections of those systems are, and none of these systems are perfect, but whatever their imperfections are, they do a much better job than we're doing. I mean, we do, I think it's fair to say, we do the worst job as a healthcare system if you've got very good insurance, you can still get fabulous health care in this country, perhaps some of the best care in the world. But as a system as a whole, we do a very poor job. And I think he's on the button. I mean, I think his film was slightly exaggerated and going to Cuba and all that kind of stuff. You know, but there's lots of systems out there around the world which are not socialist. They're private medicine, they're private hospitals, they're private insurance companies. They're just much more regulated than our system.
When you talk about regulated, part of those systems is the fact that they will establish a certain protocol and sort of look at best practices and figure out what works best. And there may be fewer treatment options. Is there reason to believe that we would sacrifice research and development if we were to move to a system where there were fewer options available based on how much they might cost?
I think you'd have to say, I think it's hard to say. I mean, I think that's certainly a possibility that you'd get less innovation because stuff would have to be tested. I mean, what happens in countries like Britain and Germany is that very expensive cancer drugs, for example, aren't approved for general use until there's good evidence that they work. And, you know, some of the most expensive treatments may extend life, you know, a few weeks at most. And if you're making a decision for a system, that may be very good thing for an individual and their families, but it may not be a good thing for a system. So it's difficult at the margins to say that it wouldn't sort of stop all kind of innovation. But what's true at the moment is an awful lot of the things we do in medicine have no evidence to support them. I mean, they're just not scientifically validated. So there is tremendous wastage in the system at the moment. And those systems in countries like Germany and Switzerland, they're pretty good. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that those countries are kind of backward. But I mean, I do accept there's some merit to this argument about would this limit innovation. And I think that's just one of the things we have to take into account. We can't have everything.
Let's go next to Karen in Dallas. Hello, Karen.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, again, a little bit related to how they operate in other countries with health care, but if we had a universal program and the insurance providers were required to be not-for-profit, would that, in the author's view, help to reduce the cost of health care and increase access, or is this problem so complex?
I mean, that's pretty interesting. What we found when we went around the world is that there is all other countries do not allow insurance companies to make a profit for basic care. It's just something you find in Japan, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Taiwan, and so forth. And it may well be that, you know, so what the companies do is they take in revenue in premiums and they pay out to medical providers and they're adjusted every year. And it may well be that not making a profit is just makes them easier to regulate. Or it may well be that it's a kind of critical factor, and it's very hard to know because the profits that insurance companies make in this country are only about 5 or 6%. So it's hard to see in some ways why that would be a critical factor, but it is something we found. We didn't find a single country which allowed insurance companies to make a profit. So you may be right, and I think that's one of the things which would have to be argued. It's going to be very difficult. I mean, the private insurance company business is a very large business, and I don't think it would be very easy to sort of, as part of reform, to actually say that they can't make a profit. You could try, but it would make reform even harder than it's going to be.
So if no element along the chain is making vast, outsized profits, is it possible to say exactly where the problem is, or is it problems on every single chain link in the chain?
Well, I think it's problems on every single link of the chain, but you do have huge expenses with new technology. I mean, one of the things which you find is in the last 6 months of life when people spend an awful lot of money, if you look at sort of what people spend in the last 6 months of life at different hospitals, so at UCLA in California, they spend $50,000, but at the Mayo Clinic, they spend $25,000. So they're both fabulous hospitals, but one hospital's got more specialists and does more procedures, and there's no difference in outcome, but it spends twice as much as another hospital. I mean, you have all kinds of things going on in medicine that are not scientifically validated. So you have tremendous potential savings in medicine. And that goes back to the question of before, you know, what's the efficacy, what's the effectiveness of different procedures? So I think there are some big issues, big savings down the road to be had in the practice of medical care. But you're right, but it is probably a huge chain. So, I mean, at every stage, we spend more on administration. So Taiwan, which was one of the countries we visited last year, they maybe spend 2% on administrative costs as compared to us, you know, which is more like 24% of every dollar goes on administration if you add up the insurance and the medical providers.
Let's go next to Frisco and speak to Lakshmi. Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering why the medical expenses in U.S. is so expensive. Like in India, it would cost like 1/10 of what it would cost here to have a very complicated heart surgery. I mean, the outcome is the same, like a person's life is saved. But I was just wondering why it would cost like $200,000 here, where it would be like 1/10 the same money. Like, is it like the services here are superior, or the drugs here are better? I was just wondering what the reason
That's a fascinating question. One of the things we've seen recently involving your India is what's called medical outsourcing, where people go to places like India or Thailand to have elective surgery because, as you say, it's much, much cheaper. And I think there's various reasons for this. I mean, I think obviously the salaries of doctors are much higher here than they are in India. But as far as I know, elective surgery is one of those places that hospitals make their money. So they, you know, because they have to pay for so much uncompensated care, they have to make up for it in different ways. And so elective surgical procedures is one of the areas where they, I think, they know they can get away with charging more. And so I think that's why you get the difference between, say, a $200,000 operation here and a $20,000 operation in Bombay, say. And I think the other argument about drugs is that this is still the market where they make most of their profits. So even if, even for a Swiss drug company, they need the American market, which is much less regulated, you know, which is much more of a market than in sort of in Switzerland, the European markets where the government controls the prices.
John Palfreyman is my guest. He's a producer for PBS Frontline. His special Stick Around America will air tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. John Palfreyman is my guest. He's a producer for PBS Frontline. Stick Around America is a Frontline special airing tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. We have an email here from Wayne who says, I have some friends who are convinced that if we got universal health care coverage, there would not be enough care to go around. I believe this could be dealt with, but I can't give them a good answer as to how.
Well, there are some questions about whether we have enough primary care physicians in this country. Most European countries have roughly twice as many primary care physicians than we have. We have a lot of specialists because if you rack up huge medical bills, you know, you want to have good earnings as a specialist to pay off your medical bills. So relatively few people go into primary care. So, I mean, that's a possibility. If we had universal health care, that maybe there would be a shortage initially. There would be growing pains. So it's not, and they found that to some extent in Massachusetts, where they've really gone from sort of, they've covered another 400,000 people in the last couple of years. So they have had some trouble finding access to physicians. So it's a good point, I think.
I know that a lot of doctors take umbrage at the assumption that they are just making money hand over fist, because they'll talk about the fact that, you know, depending on their area of specialization, a huge percentage of their salary ultimately pays for malpractice insurance. Is that part of the problem as well?
I think it's part of the problem. I think it's probably a small part of the problem, but it's one that gets people very angry. And, you know, and I think you have to take that seriously. I don't think if we eliminated malpractice insurance as a problem, we'd still have escalating healthcare costs. So, but I mean, we should do it anyway. We should address it and take it seriously.
Let's go next to Louisville and speak with Brett. Hi, Brett.
Hey, how you doing? Great show, and thank both of you for what you're doing. I have a quick comment. I own a business here in Dallas, Fort Worth, and I provide health insurance to my employees. And I've noticed, I don't know if something's changed over the past 5 or 6 years, but I can pretty much count on a 15 to 25% increase year over year of cost for insurance premiums. And prior to that, I noticed maybe a 5 to 10% max increase year over year. And I'm wondering if there's anything that happened that caused this massive change in healthcare cost premiums.
I mean, this is a complaint. You're a small business, Brad, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is a complaint that I heard from small business people, men and women all over the country, that the premiums are going up from year to year 10 or 15%, and they're forced to keep switching insurers, right? There's no continuity, and it's very difficult to escape the idea that, even though your health history is not supposed to sort of discriminate against you, we found examples of places where people had had an expensive pregnancy or they made a particularly expensive claim 1 year, and then the next year the premiums skyrocket as a consequence. It's what's called experience rating. And it obviously doesn't happen with these very large companies like General Electric and Microsoft. They can sort of absorb these costs. But with small businesses, you do find this problem, and it's a very difficult puzzle. I mean, you're better off than if you get insurance, they have to cover people that work for you, so that's a good thing. It's better to be insured than to be applying in the individual market. But you don't get, small businesses complain that they don't get the continuity from year to year. So I heard exactly what you say from many quarters, Brad. Yeah.
Do businesses get any sort of discount on the insurance they buy for their employees if they, I don't know, provide a gym or encourage them to quit smoking or things like that?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they get a tax break, but that may be true in some of the bigger insurers, but I don't really know about that for small. I doubt that for small insurance companies.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we go to Grand Prairie and speak to Wosu. Hi, Wosu.
Yes, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I've always enjoyed your program. Yeah, he mentioned that Medicare is one of the rising costs of healthcare system. Then in his finding, did he find out about litigation, lawsuit and malpractices compared to other countries and the U.S., which is also in addition to the rising cost of healthcare system here?
We had a sort of a poor connection. I don't know if you were able to hear.
Yeah, I heard okay. That. Basically, yes, malpractice is one of the things you are. If you ask physicians when you go around the world whether they have to pay large malpractice insurance, they don't, because malpractice exists, malpractice litigation exists, but it's much less common. So it is a factor. It's not the biggest factor. The biggest factor is new technology and new procedures and utilization. You know, the number of scans that are done, they're not all done because people are afraid of litigation. They're done because people like scans and because providers make money when they do scans. I mean, there's lots of reasons why healthcare increases. If you go to other countries, they have price schedules. They set the prices for scans. So in Japan, if a provider, you know, does twice as many scans as they did the year before, they reduce the price that they're going to get for each scan. And that's the only way that they control utilization with these dramatic sort of central regulations. That's not something we do, or, I mean, it's very hard to us imagine us doing it, but that's how they control the costs. But litigation's a factor, but I don't think it's a huge factor.
I have an email here from David who writes, I thought I was pretty well covered and protected from catastrophic medical issues until my wife suffered a stroke at the age of 45 and was in intensive care for over a month and various rehab centers for the next 2 years. She's now fairly functional, but the process to get her there destroyed us financially and ruined both of our credit ratings. I believe I've done everything right in terms of getting the right amount of insurance coverage and had hardly used it in the previous 20 years. There should be some sort of national safety net for these types of catastrophic medical and financial disasters. David's email points out the fact that it comes up in the film. Many Americans don't really know what's in the coverage they're paying for.
No, and it sounds like he's exceeded his caps. That, you know, some of these consumer-directed healthcare plans have limits on what you can pay out. And so if you get a major catastrophe like he sounds like he's got, you will exceed it at some point, and then you'll have to, then you're paying out of your own savings and you're vulnerable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Linda in Colleyville. Hello, Linda.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, thank you so much.
Sure.
I am a small business owner, and I was insured through a trust for 2 years. I was notified with 1 day notice that the Texas Attorney General had issued a cease and desist order. That left me with no health insurance. During that 2 year period, I paid to have a sleeve gastric bypass that was very successful, and I lost 80% of the weight that I was, that I was overweight. I have been declined by all major health insurance companies now for a 5 year period until the gastric bypass is, decided that it was effective and safe, even though I'm on no medication. I was before for obesity, and I have had no problems at all and have stabilized my weight.
So in other words, even though you didn't make a claim to an insurance company for this care, you're
correct,
still not able to get care.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
She has a pre-existing health history, which makes it difficult for you to get insurance unless you got insurance through an employer. So that's your – there's two options I can see for you. One is to get an employee-based health care. The other is the Texas high-risk pool, which would make you wait and would be very expensive as well. You had to pay, presumably, your bypass. You paid out of pocket, Linda, right?
My second short-term insurance, the 6 month.
But you paid for that out of pocket for the bypass procedure.
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you know it's crazy because before I had insurance that paid for all the kinds of medication and obviously the catastrophic diabetes and whatever else I was going to have done. But now because I have taken a very proactive step and improved my health, I cannot get insurance.
But you still have a business, Linda?
Yes, I do.
So you should be able to get it through your business. If you employ more than two people, you should be able to get a small business policy.
Are insurance companies required to extend policies to any business that applies, provided that they pay the premiums?
Yeah, any business that's more between 2 and 50 employees is usually the case in most states, and so they have to do guaranteed issue. I mean, it may still cost you a lot, but they have to offer it to any legitimate business. I mean, they can't medically underwrite you like they can as an individual. And I believe it's 2 to 50 people.
Let's go next to Ted in Irving. Hello, Ted.
Ted, yes. Hi, I'm a cardiologist. I'm going to talk a little bit on the other side of the coin. I've been listening to your conversations, and I agree with everything that the gentleman has stated, and as a cardiologist. And I personally feel that the solution to this problem will have to be a national health care system. I think right now we have Medicare, and Medicare does make an attempt to control costs. Physicians that subscribe to Medicare have to take what their allowable fees are, and the hospitals are supposed to do the same. The problem is when you start dealing with private insurance companies, they will allow only a certain percentage of the payment that the hospital charges or the physician charges, and you don't really know that when you've applied to their policy. I had a situation where my wife, and I'm a cardiologist, I know about medical expenses, was in an accident, and we had very, very good insurance, and the insurance company disallowed nearly half of the charges that the hospital or the physicians would apply. And when you call the insurance company, they can't explain why. They just say that this is their maximum limit for charges.
Hmm. My
personal feeling is that the only solution is that the government has to regulate costs like they do with Medicare, and then these different areas of money, that the profits that are made at the different levels along, I totally agree with them. And the physicians are greatly responsible for this.
Do more of your colleagues agree with that, Ted, today than they did 10 years ago?
That's my question. Do you think if we had a Medicare price schedule for all medical care, do you think your colleagues would accept that, or would they rebel?
I think that many of them would. I think that some of them would accept that and some of them would rebel. But I think the situation, the way it's going now, is your problem with family care in this country is absolutely true, and the reason is because the reimbursements from Medicare are greatly swayed toward doing procedures, as you said earlier. And I'm a cardiologist, and I do procedures. So I can generate money doing procedures, and if there's an equivocal situation in terms of some of my colleagues, they would prefer to do the money generating procedure if it's an equivocal situation.
Right.
For instance, let me give you an example. For coronary arteriography that we do, if you look at the data, there are some studies that show that you can treat patients medically, or alternatively, you can do a heart cath and then an angioplasty and correct the situation. Well, there's data that long-term survival studies don't show a benefit when you're doing a stent or an intervention.
Right.
So some of these people could be treated medically. The costs of medical therapy in that situation are much less than going through a procedure where you may actually help the patient, but to show a long-term benefit, as you stated earlier in your talk, the European countries would not do this.
Ted, correct. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you, Ted.
Definitely sounds like we're hearing frustration on all sides, John. And I'm sure you encountered that when you were reporting for the documentary.
Yeah, no, it's extremely interesting to hear from medical providers, because I think they're going to be the big factor in what going forward from here is whether we can get them to the table, like Ted, to help with the issue.
What is your sense in terms of whether or not we can sort of seize the zeitgeist and really change it this time? We've talked about this multiple times over the past several decades. Are we closer to fundamentally changing the way we do healthcare in this country than we have been in the past?
Well, I think we are, but I think it has to happen this year, and there's so many other things going on, it's difficult to, you know, to really be terribly confident that it will work. You know, part of the optimism I have is that President Obama seems to have seen that healthcare reform is fundamental to fiscal reform, because if you look ahead and you look at what happens to the price of the big federal programs, Medicare and Medicaid, they go berserk in about 10 or 20 years, and you have to solve that sooner or later. It's not something you can really kick down the road for much longer at all. So if you're going to have to do it, you might as well, if you're going to do one thing this year, it might as well be healthcare reform.
Last thing I want to ask you briefly is why some Americans seem so afraid of changing the way things are now when we have so much evidence that it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because they might be okay with their own. Still, most Americans get their insurance through their employers, and the employer pays most of the premium, and most people like their doctor, and most people are sort of satisfied, and they don't feel personally threatened, even though they probably know somebody who's in trouble. And for some reason, they're just not angry or, you know, worked up enough to insist. I mean, I've heard it said that, you know, Washington would turn on a dime if people really were angry enough about it. I mean, just look what happened with the AIG, you know, executive compensation. I mean, when people are angry, things happen in Washington. But it seems like we're not angry enough, and that I think is one of the mysteries.
Sick Around America airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13. John Palfreyman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. Bye-bye.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.